You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Daily Nationalist. This is the first Daily Nationalist of the new year, 2026. We're just a couple of days away from old calendar Christmas. And for those who celebrate that, I hope it goes very well. It was great raising children on the calendar, on the old calendar, because they had all the fun on the Santa Christmas, December 25th, but the real one on the evening of the 6th was liturgical and solemn, and it was all St. Nicholas rather than Santa, so there was never any question about St. Nicholas existing. It's a totally different thing, and not to mention you get the best prices on things after Christmas. Anyway, we're going to talk about a man today that I have never mentioned before, probably the most political of all of the new martyrs. And that is the new martyr Ivan Vostorgov, born 1867, was murdered in 1918. We're going to talk about him in his writings on socialism and the state. And he was, when I say political, I'm not talking about campaigns, elections, and voting. I'm talking about ideology, issues of justice. There was no way to be apolitical in Russia in 1917. Ideology is all that existed. And parties were making promises that they had no intention keeping. I remember when they were writing, John Vostorgov is writing, I've been through his 5 volumes. It took me a while to find one with a table of contents. So initially I went with one without, and that was far more difficult. Then I finally found one in Russian that I don't think it's in English that does have a table of contents, and that made my life a little bit easier. And he wrote a lot. He was the head of the Monarchist Union. He was devoted to the Black Hundreds. He was a firm monarchist in every way possible, connecting Russian monarchism with nationalism. Now, there is an issue with him, and this is one of the reasons why I haven't really talked about him until now. It's possible he actually supported the provisional government. Just go to Wikipedia. It'll tell you that he did. Although it's very difficult for me to find. I found one Russian source that says he did. Most other sources don't mention it, so it's an argument from silence. Today, in 2026, we know that Tsar Nicholas never abdicated. We know all the reasons why. I've been through that already. They didn't have the web in 1905, 1911, 1917. You got to remember that the provisionals were saying, well, we're just going to... We may reinstate the monarchy after a constituent assembly is called, or there really is nothing you could do about it anyway. And of course, almost the entire church went over to the provisional government, which is something else that it makes us very upset. And Russian nationalists sometimes have some trouble with it. I'm not 100% sure if he did or if he did. He did it because he believed the lies of the press at the time. You know, all the bishops are doing it. You know, maybe they are going to provide a new and you know the fake abdication thing, which did not exist, says that please support the provisional government. So he thinks he's doing the Tsar's duty, which doesn't make a lot of sense. But that would also mean that he would throw all of his previous political theory out the window. And that's why I still hold out hope that it's kind of a myth. Good sources on him in Russian or in English on that respect are hard to find. But even if he did support the provisional government at the time, without things like the web, with quick information constantly moving from place to place, well, he thought it was the right thing to do. The bishops were doing it. They were going to call. They were going to, you know, Tsar Nicholas said to support it. It's only temporary. Monarchy's only gone temporarily, which was said at the time. So, anyway. Then at a point, he kind of stopped his political work and became a missionary. And he was a missionary all over the place. His very first academic work was against the Old Believers, specifically the hierarchy in Austria. But he became a missionary in places in the Caucasus and elsewhere amongst the Muslims. And at a young age, in a basement, August of 1918 near Moscow, he was shot without any kind of trial by an early iteration of the Cheka. With a group of other clergymen. Regardless of all that, what he actually wrote was very consistently nationalist, royalist, and anti-communist. He talked about Marx. I mean, we know what happened in the Soviet Union. He didn't. I mean, he was an early statistic. He made predictions that all came true. The system that they were arguing for just didn't make any sense. And in fact, the entire volume 5 of his works is entirely based on, he wrote a whole catechism against socialism. Marxist socialism, the notion that, you know, production is all that matters. He was extremely well-educated and extremely well-read. He knew what he was talking about. He was dangerous as a political theorist, and he should be taken far more seriously than he is, but that's, I guess, is never going to happen. He's a very interesting guy. I'm going to talk about his, I don't know if we're going to get it all done today. Maybe we will, maybe we won't, I don't know. So, going through all of his works was actually a lot of fun. I haven't done it in a while. And I came across something in Volume 3 of his collected works from 1907. It was called The Pagan and the Christian State. And it's an excellent work. And he starts off by talking about the Feast of the Exaltation of the Cross. Talking about its nature and its power. And he talks about the prayer. The cross is the guardian of the universe. The cross is the beauty of the church. The cross is the confirmation of the faithful. The cross is the glory of angels. The cross is the plague of demons. Among the praises, there's another one. The cross is the power of kings. And then later, the cross is the praise and confirmation of kings and kingdoms. And it's easy just to skip over that. But he gets deeper into it. How is the cross the power of kings? And it's what separates pagan from Christian states. The king is a cross bearer. The prayers for the granting of victory, peace, protection, success, for all the royal undertakings. The patrimony, the abode of the Lord. Remember the Troparion? You hear this probably every day. O Lord, save thy people and bless thine inheritance. Grant victory to your kingdom over their adversaries, and by virtue of thy cross, preserve thine estate. This isn't just a personal prayer for the Tsar and the kingdom. There's more there. Now the modernists will say, victory to Orthodox Christians. Others say, to the Commonwealth. What I just read was the original. And words king or kingdom in that prayer have been removed long ago. And I have a problem with that. Doesn't matter whether you live under a monarchy or not. So, of course, Orthodox people pray for any monarch that may rule over them. Now, he also holds that we are obligated to pray for rulers who are unfaithful, heterodox. And he's right to an extent, but you know, only for their conversion. He doesn't say that. But now, the Christian church began to pray the prayer I just read since the time of St. Constantine the Great. That was a cross and the crown. The cross was a symbol of spiritual strength. It was placed on the banners, sometimes in place of the eagle, which was physical strength, sometimes replacing it entirely. And of course, they were blessed with a cross upon their accession to the throne in any Christian kingdom anywhere. But when you say the cross is the power of kings, as it says in that prayer, that's where the entire church confesses they live in a Christian state, not a pagan or a secular one. In the early 20th century, St. Ivan saw that the Orthodox desperately needed to understand these concepts. This was a period of time where you had reformers preaching on every corner. You had full freedom of speech, of course, far more so than in the West. It was a big mistake. We'll talk about that in a little bit here. He says, a thirst of social reform has gripped Russian society. Well, I don't know if he means just the elite or everybody, but, he saw the winds coming, as did St. John of Kronstadt, who he loved and he was very close to. Let me quote him directly here. A pagan state, on the other hand, is a purely earthly, secular kingdom. Its patriotism, therefore, is simple and crude. It's just a collective egoism. Its task in external relations is to demonstrate and display its strength, to seize as many advantages as possible in the global arena, to subjugate as many peoples and countries as possible, to seize as many economic benefits as possible. Initially, its task boiled down to providing its members with as much comfort and worldly benefit as possible. The common interest, the shared desire for such comfort and acquisition, serve as a unifying force. The sense of self-preservation and the struggle for existence and the desire to secure oneself the best possible material existence on earth, that's the foundation for the pagan state. Power in it is a necessity stemming from the same considerations of utility and advantage. The state, that is, guided by secular and even materialist principles. Power comes from a melange of sources. And he does mock the concept of the people, which was, most of my listeners know, drives me insane. But that doesn't mean anything. Power emanates from the people who agree to establish it for their own benefit, whatever that might be. That the people in such societies can destroy the societies and remake it to suit their needs. But spiritual interests are nowhere to be found. Those are private matters. You know, this is essentially the liberal order. And you had plenty of people advocating it at the time. It's not the same when the state is a Christian one. Christianity is an eternal and fully universal force from the first days of its existence. It extends its influence in all aspects of human life. How could it bypass the state or the nation or the family? Modernists have a tough time answering that. The church covers everything. If the family is natural, then so is the state. Or I should say, really, so is the nation. And they will exist in the afterlife. According to the Christian view, the state is not an end in itself. And it never is. But it's only a means. It's a means for us to navigate our earthly path towards the eternal and sacred goals of human existence, eternal salvation. Of course, Christian states concern itself with, you know, external security of the nation, their internal well-being, of course. But that's not the end. It's just a means for its members to best achieve the fundamental and primary purpose of its existence. You have to have peace and order in order for anything to happen. And for us to be calm enough to pursue the goals, religious goals, there has to be peace and order. But all state life has to be subordinated to such goals. It determines legislation, the system, and whatever reform might be coming down the pike. Everything in the state has to be imbued with these goals to serve them, to be defined by them. The state is not a self-sufficient entity, as in the pagan world. It's not a conquest by violence. It's not a manifestation of the people's aristocracy, people's autocracy. Not a matter of state benefit. Power, I should say authority in this particular case, because power and authority are two very different things. Authority is a manifestation of divine government, an organ of divine education. Now what happens? You take away the cross, remove it from the king's crown, remove it from the state. Power of kings will just be human, worldly, fragile, as he says, rotten, and the edifice of human kingdoms will forever be built on sand. We are nationalists, as he was, but it isn't the vague collective egotism. You have that today. I just came across, military men are such a weird bunch. They're so unimaginative. So whatever your opinions on Maduro, congratulations on a flawless operation. Well, we don't know if it's flawless or not. The U.S. lies about its casualties all the time. We'll be talking about that on Thursday. This is what we mean, however. That's the opposite of the cross is the power of kings. It's not earthly interests. It's not benefits of the so-called majority. It's the duty of the Christian conscience. The will of the people is, as always, a meaningless phrase. It's not a new God, certainly not a measure of moral goodness. It's not the foundation of all activity. The will of the people is vague. It could refer to anything. Generally speaking, back then, when anyone referred to the people, they were referring to, you know, either the party or, you know, aristocratic, those who were involved in, you know, political discourse in the capital. That was society, not everybody. St. Ivan was murdered before he saw his worst nightmares come to fruition. When you go through the writings of members, the Black Hundreds and monarchist groups of the period, you see that they knew, however vaguely, what was coming down the pike. Politically, St. Ivan is best known for his lengthy analyses of socialism. It's very good. And I'm going to quote from his Beware of Deceptive Propaganda. He says, this is 1906, deceptive, pernicious propaganda is now spread throughout Russia, both secretly and openly. They're luring people into their nets, often sincere and good. But they don't understand the deception, don't see how they're being exploited by the enemies of the faith, the church, enemies of Russia. Such are the common people, peasants and workers, to whom false teachers falsely promise all sorts of blessings. These are often young, inexperienced, enthusiastic people, educated or semi-educated, who think they are selflessly sacrificing themselves for the common good, while in reality, they serve only to bring about general unrest, disorder, and the destruction of their homeland. St. Ivan Vestorgov has many, many quotable passages. And I should note that he spoke of the Jews and the Talmud quite often in his work. It's one of the reasons he was murdered. He knew exactly what was happening. He talks about the self-proclaimed teachers and champions of the people. Yeah, they have various names. They don't even agree on each other with everything. They have all kinds of different parties. They're divided. They're always making promises, claiming all these benefits in the future. But whatever they call themselves, their deeds, and he's writing in 1906, are open to all. The revolution of 1905 had failed. It had also become clear that their teachings and actions... Well, put it this way. It's difficult to reconcile what they teach and what they do. They teach and speak about the good of the people, but in fact they bring great harm and great pain to the people. And not for a year or two, but for decades. Now he's referring to, in that particular, when he talks like that, that wasn't a quote, but it was a paraphrase. If it was a quote, I'm going to tell you it's a quote. If you followed Pete and I on the Solzhenitsyn book, we spent some time on the 1905 revolution. And it's very clear that the communists, the Jews especially, would walk into factories and get, you know, force workers to strike, whether they wanted to or not. So what it leads to is, you know, the work stoppages of all kinds, destruction of other people's estates and property, railways and the strikes in the pharmacies, stores, factories, and plants. All this is caused by false teachings, deceptive teaching, propaganda. Ultimately, it's brought poverty and ruin to thousands. after the forced closure of factories and plants by the left left their workers without a living. All of this has led to the rise in prices of everything, necessary products of life. And deaths have been a result of it. These teachers forced to stop work, even expelling students from schools, forcibly remove workers who have not succumbed to their wars and don't sympathize with their decisions. Solzhenitsyn speaks at great length about the universities. You know, there's a reason why, you know, the old monarchs didn't want Jews in their universities. It primarily was because the minute they got there, if there were a certain number of them, it became an operation for leftist political policy. As I've said before, you didn't have the riot control tactics that you do today. So things, you know, rifles and swords were used, but these were provoked. He's writing in 1906, and by then, dozens and dozens and dozens of officials had been assassinated by the left, by gunfire, by bombs. Hundreds of soldiers, Cossacks, police officers, they're only doing their job. Bombs were thrown into crowds just to kill one person, and dozens of people were hurt. Many were killed. Women and small children were blown to pieces, as happened in Sevastopol and St. Petersburg. Now, the financial end of this, we've talked about many times before. This was an era, at one time, the Japanese were sending money to the left, but once the war ended, they didn't have any money anyway. And it certainly wasn't the only, so I think the Japanese were a very minor source. There was a booklet at the time called The Inside Story of the Russian Revolution, talking about 1905. Showing the Japanese connection to the revolutionary movement. Well, that's fine, but that's not the only source. But the war ended, and the Japanese stopped paying. So what happened? They started to rob banks, attack commercial premises in broad daylight, shooting owners and clerks and workers, small businessmen, opened up protection rackets. It became dangerous to appear on the streets at all. Everyone's being robbed for the sake of freedom. They forced money from the workers. They were not granted it, but mostly sent from abroad. These tragic events occurred in Moscow and several other places. We talked about Bloody Sunday. And he says, I'm quoting him here, he says, by mutual agreement, certain non-Russian tribes, of course he's, you know, tongue-in-cheek referring to the Jews, hating everything Russian, simultaneously joined them on the outskirts of the state. Here it became clear with whom the false teachers were working. The enemies of the Russian people and the Russian state. Thus, the word of the gospel about such people was fulfilled. They are ravenous wolves, coming in sheep's clothing, and by their fruit you shall know them. So then he asked the question, why, despite the clear harm that they cause, are people drawn to them? Remember, we're in a society that's far healthier than the one we live in now. You know, he was panicking about his society in 1906. I can only imagine if he was here with me right now, or you know, on a university campus right now, how he would react. He answers the question in a few different ways. He says, well, the evil people among us will always be attracted to stuff like that. who are lazy and corrupt, the drunk, people who are thrown out of everywhere, the homeless, street idlers. Well, that's a good chunk of them too. Those who want to get rich quick and easy. Those who have nothing to lose. They don't feel sorry for anyone. They don't have to protect anyone. They want to eat and drink for free, work less. Feel like a boss, a leader. But the conscience can't be entirely extinguished. So fine words have to be used. Now, I've always stated that the violent bomb throwers in Antifa, many of them, you know, they know a few slogans about the situation. They don't really know anything. They don't even know what we believe. Well, university professors don't know what we believe. Being against racism and throwing, attacking cops. Well, they would do that anyway. Only in this case, they have these fine words to justify it. Then they'll assure everyone the suffering, the unrest, that's only temporary. And when power falls into the hands of the self-appointed teachers and preachers, then all suffering, deprivation, and imperfection will disappear. And they'll say something about equality. No rich, no poor. Peasants owning land, which they did already. And the workers will be masters of the railways and the factories and the plants. And St. Ivan realizes that this is a new form of religion because it's faith. Socialism, the followers of all parties of socialism at the time in Russia, they're false promises, talking about the common good, talking about an earthly paradise, happiness of all people. It's a way for evil people to cover up evil deeds, violence, robbery, riots, murder. So many people were killed at the time. There were so many killed in the 1960s, early 1970s against the Vietnam War. They could burn down universities, and not only did they get away with it, but they're university professors now, probably retired, boomers. But they were, you know, they would say this is, we're against racism, we're against the war. But there are sincere people. What's come up in Solzhenitsyn's work, 200 years together, is that you did have some legitimate idealistic socialists who were not Jews, who were starting to get upset over the fact that Jews were this aristocracy that seemed to have everything, that seemed to get away with everything. They think that they're pursuing some kind of equality, which Marx did not talk about. Get to that here in a second. And yet you have these wealthy Jews. Now, the leaders of the Communist Party usually came from the upper classes. Engels himself was a factory owner. You know, Marx worked for the New York Times. They all worked for American newspapers at one time or another. The point is that you had so-called anti-Semitism growing within the Communist Party of the Soviet Union for this reason. And St. Ivan Vostorgov was actually laid out the cause for it in 1906. But for the rest of those who follow socialism, there is a grain of truth to it. Of course there is, more than a grain. And much that's desirable. The socialists, they couldn't be quoting Marx on the street corners. He was too difficult of a writer. They could talk about labor being underpaid, workers living in poverty, the owners live in lavish estates or something like that. duties, taxes, obligations are distributed sometimes unevenly. Injustice is everywhere. So they claim that when they take over, everything, not just in Russia, but on Earth, will be arranged so that everyone has everything. There'll be no weak, there'll be no poor. That truth on Earth triumphs over everything. That's the nature of the propaganda. The most terrible enemy is the one who approaches you disguised as a friend and well-wisher. This is how the devil operated. This is how the devil tempted Eve. Becoming like gods. Let's face it, no one on Earth can justify American capitalism in 2026. No one. The U.S. is an oligarchy, and it functions like an oligarchy. So any talk about a market doesn't make any sense. There is no market. It's a command economy run by a few hundred very powerful families. He talks about these people being indignant at injustice. But how do you choose which teacher is correct and incorrect, good and evil? Well, the conscience does, but conscience itself requires instruction. And that they clash. Let me quote to make this clearer. It's from the same paper here. Conscience is a voice of God within man, but man can stifle and distort this voice. That is why God himself, through his revelation, through his holy faith, through religion, the Church of Christ, directs man's conscience towards eternal and true goodness. But about God, about religion, about Christ the Savior, about his law, about his church, the most important thing, the most crucial thing for a believer, socialism is completely silent. And is silent about it, intentionally. Not just silent about it, but knows that it's going to be destroying it when they take over, or if they take over. They're not going to tell the common people that. That's from the same article. So what is man without the church? Why should man be guided by justice and compassion at all? Without religion, man is an intelligent animal. The law of his life is the law of the struggle of existence. The Darwinian law, unmitigated by religion or anything else, that leads to oligarchy, the oppression of the weak by the strong. Without religion, man is merely a child of nature. In nature, there is no moral or immoral. There's no duty, there's no moral duty or anything like that. We see the nasty things that happen. Babies getting eaten by a male in a lion pride. It's not immoral. There's an instinctive drive to do that. But for human beings, without God's law, people are guided by what is useful or pleasant, what's going to bring them to power, what brings them any kind of benefit or pleasure. Without a concept of duty, people end up precisely where we see them, in the animal kingdom. The strong dominate the weak and enslave them without pity. The socialism, they deliberately remain silent or reject religion entirely. Destroy, does not like, they didn't say this, they played nice at the time about the church. In fact, they pretended to be the perfect manifestation of Christ's teachings. Let me quote him again here, and this is a good one. However, sometimes socialists also refer to Christianity, not out of belief in its truth, because both teachers of socialists are Jews, haters of Christianity, but in order to be more easily attract believers to their side. You are Christ, they say. It's already clear from that expression that they do not recognize him. Bequeath the same to socialism, because the first Christians in Jerusalem had everything in common, gave their houses, money, and everything for the common use. Those last words, what do those last words say about the life of the first Christians? chapter 4, Acts of the Apostles, the apostle says, the multitude of those who believed were of one heart and one mind. There was no one among them who needed, or who wanted. For as many who owned lands and houses, when they sold them, they brought the proceeds, what was sold and laid at the apostles' feet. It was given to each one as he absolutely needed. Verse 34 and 35. So when the socialists cite this passage from our Christian holy book, of course, they have no conception of what it actually means. What was the reason for the common division of property among the early Christians? And we know what happened. We know what existed. I think the Acts of the Apostles are right. They had one mind and one heart. This was new. Christ had just ascended. This is a unity among people. The first Christians did not resort to violence, however. They sold their possessions at their own pleasure. But they did not take these possessions from those who sold them, as today's socialists do. They could have simply taken money from everyone for the common use instead of acquiring it by selling homes and property. But an arbitrary and violent division made today will give rise to another arbitrary and violent redistribution tomorrow. And so on, without end. There will be no equality, but only enmity and violence. And then he talks about the next chapter in the Acts of the Apostles. Husband and wife, Aeneas and Sapphira, sold their property but didn't contribute all the money, only a small portion of it, even lying about the price, saying that, "We brought everything. This is it." Very harshly, they were killed. Not by the apostles. They were killed by God himself. The apostle Peter said to Aeneas, "What you possess was not your own. What you purchased by selling was not in your own power. Why have you allowed Satan to fill your heart to lie to the Holy Spirit? You have not lied to men, but to God." Acts 5, 3, 4. So if there was no force used, everything that they did was done voluntarily. They blasphemed. They were killed because they blasphemed the Holy Spirit, ultimately. Aeneas and his wife were killed for lying, not for not giving all the money that they had for the common use. Then he asked a question. Do socialists think about the moral development of people? Of course, the answer is no, because Marx didn't believe in ethics or any kind of abstraction whatsoever. Marx's system, remember, was, in his mind, a scientific one. There was no morality about it. This is social science. But their followers, of course, are going to say nothing about morality. They're on one thing: production, bread, drink, clothing, land, capital. Now, today, I don't think socialists talk about that. They certainly don't talk about equality. And they refuse to consider why there's so much injustice in the distribution of goods, malice and violence on the part of both the rich and the poor. It stems from moral imperfection, from human sinfulness, and this they reject. And if that's not corrected, nothing will help people to improve their lives. And he says, he gives an example. He says, no matter how you treat a case of carbon monoxide poisoning, if a person remains in a fumes-filled room and in fumes-filled air, no medicine's going to help. And of course, it's the same thing here. even if everything is divided equally, greed, deceit, and malice will emerge. After the division, if there's anything else they could do to poison each other's lives, they'll do it. I don't know if any of you know the pyramid scheme plan in Albania in the early 90s. Look it up if you don't. It's hilarious only you know, unless you consider it hurt a lot of people. It hurt 2/3 of the country were involved. People were given, you know, state property was sold off. People were given vouchers, and scammers immediately took over. Now, Vostotogov seems to think, and a lot of people do, a lot of educated people do, that Marxism is focused on equality. Theoretically, it didn't. Equality is an abstraction Marx would never use. He never used abstractions at all. And here's why I say this. In the Critique of the Gotha Program in 1875, this is what Marx says. In a higher phase of communist society, after the enslaving and subordination of the individual to the division of labor, and therewith also the antithesis between mental and physical labor has vanished, after labor has become not only a means of life but life's prime want, after the productive forces have also increased with the all-round development of the individual, and all the springs of cooperative wealth flow more abundantly, only then can the narrow horizons of bourgeois right be tossed in its entirety, and society inscribe on its banners, from each according to his ability, to each according to his needs. Now, I quoted the entire thing because people usually use that last line as if it's not a standalone thing. He's being very specific in how he's using it. But that last line does not suggest an equality of outcomes. The concept is that advanced socialism in Marx's world, then later Engels, motivation to work for the good of society, despite any, you know, the absence of any kind of social coercion, because work is then pleasurable. It's a creative activity. And of course, you know, no one ever puts these together. How would a revolution bring this about? Now, the USSR, at the lower stage of communism, this is their own, the Leninist concept. They were at a lower stage of communism here. Soviet Union adapted that formula, and they started to say, from each according to his ability, to each according to his contribution, or to, according to his labor. That was actually in the Soviet Constitution, 1936. Now, of course, the word need is never defined. Earlier on. But still, in the Marxist concept, the implication of differential abilities doesn't suggest abstract equality. The point he's trying to make with all this, first and foremost, unless man is elevated morally, nothing is going to work. In a healthy society, pretty much any system will work out. You know, nationalism could always stand on all of the endless array of sociological literature. It's actually should be in political science, but I don't know. Some sociologists are dealing with it too, showing that in areas and places that are racially or ethnically homogenous, you have all the benefits any society could ever give. And reverse is also the opposite is also the case. Social trust, educational attainment, low crime, family cohesion, all of that is found only in areas, regions, countries, whatever, that have a high rate of racial or ethnic cohesion, or homogeneity, I should say, not just cohesion, homogeneity. I don't know if you know this. For many years in grad school, I worked with the homeless. I did it in Lincoln, Nebraska. I did it in St. Louis. I did it for a while, even in Chambersburg, Pennsylvania. And I got to know them. Some of them are very intelligent. Some of them, you know, we used to laugh. You can't tell them apart from the university professors, you know. I could give them $1 million tomorrow and they'll be homeless in 6 months. Money isn't the issue. Of course, money matters. But it doesn't, in and of itself, it doesn't solve the problem. One has to have the motivation, as St. Ivan says, to do good, not evil. Have the strength to do good and avoid evil. In all of our souls, there's this division where we're constantly fighting, proving that, of course, the soul is a spiritual entity. Salvation is not found in a party, of course, but found in Christ. The church provides us the knowledge of what is good and what is holy and what is sinful. The example of Christ and his saints. It's clear, it's close, especially for them. The early Christians, it's clear, close, and embodied. One of the things that make the new martyrs interesting is that they weren't that long ago. They weren't in the ancient world. This is why he's writing the way he does. You know, he could be a contemporary. Yeah, the ancients didn't write like this. The church points out to each of us, in accordance with the measure of our moral development, the motivation for moral perfection, love of God, the example of the saints. An example that is clear, close, and embodied. That's the key issue. The voice of a truly directed conscience. Do not underestimate the role of conscience here. Look at 2 Peter chapter 1. Socialism, on the other hand, dreams of equality or something like that. I don't know if you ever come across the workers' Marseillaise. I don't mean the French national anthem. I mean the socialist version. Actually, it was written in Russia. Written by Peter Lavrov, and let me quote it. And after the bloody dawn, the sun of truth and brotherly love will rise, though we've paid a terrible price. With our blood, we bought the happiness of the land, and the era of freedom will come. The lies will be gone, evil will be gone forever, and all the nations will unite into one in the free kingdom of holy labor. Well, that suggests that they do talk about some kind of moral rebirth, but they don't really understand what the foundation of that might be. It's impotent. It's sterile. It demands only faith in its words and its promises, and it goes no further than that. It's difficult expecting the fruits of love, let alone eternal love, from blood forcibly spilled. Eternal malice is more likely to spring from such things. I'm quoting him here. What if destructive idleness, laziness, drunkenness, debauchery coexist with holy labor? What if lies and evil do not vanish? With what and how can they be combated? And what should we rely on in this struggle? And of course, socialism has no answer to these questions. Having rejected faith in God, socialism presents itself as a new faith, a new religion. One One of the wonderful things about St. Ivan Vestorgov is he realizes that capitalism and socialism are very similar, especially their siblings. They have the same foundations, the same assumptions. Denying people moral improvement is perfect. That certainly serves the power of the wealthy. They can't appeal to the dictates of spirituality, religion, or anything. They can't talk about the voice of moral duty and consciousness, the moral world within us. Socialism is left without the means to influence anyone's consciousness. Everything ends up being force. Now, as I've said, and it's always struck me as interesting how Marx never really talked about what the future socialist society would be like, and that's very, very suspicious. If he wants people to go to the barricades, he wants people to be killed in revolutions, and doesn't say what's going to happen. Well, I mean, there's a few lines. Engels was a little bit more. He had more to say about it. Now, there's no way he could know at the time that Tito's worker self-management, which was actually admirable, 1950 and 1990, was never achieved. Workers' control was a failure. But that begs the question anyway. Are human needs really limited to these earthly, you know, material goods? Now, they're talking about dividing food and drink equally is the gateway to paradise. And he says, the kind of reasoning that socialists allow can only be applied to a barnyard, not to human society. But even well-fed animals, he says, fight among themselves. You talk about, you know, food and drink, clothing, shelter. Men have thousands of other needs, higher and spiritual ones. The more needs are satisfied, the more develop. They have to suppress the desire for God in people's souls. What is all of this for? It can't just be for right now. He said, you know, to think and assert that by dividing physical goods among people in one way or another, equally, more or less equally, can bring them lasting happiness. It doesn't make sense because it fails to recognize reason or free will. It is an animalistic approach to human beings. And he says again, that's perfect. That coincides entirely with the interests of the capitalists. They love men being at the level of animals. He says, for a representative of capital, a person's significance depends on the possession of money, land, a factory, that is, on the possession of material goods. But isn't that the same for a socialist? No, of course. Man shall not live by bread alone, by every word that proceeds from the mouth of God. That's always been the interpretation of that. What happens to their God is their belly, as they say, as in the gospel. That's the foundation of all forms of leftism and socialism. And they claim further that I've discussed this in the past, and he does a very good job here dealing with this. The question of being born free and equal. This is something where liberals and communists seem to agree. Somehow they're born free and equal by nature. That doesn't make any sense. It simply isn't true. A newborn child is absolutely dependent. Totally dependent on those around it. Of course, all of us are dependent on those around us. We can't build our own homes. We can't deliver our own mail. We can't, you know, depend on ourselves for medical care. And beyond that, there's simply no equality. Healthy and weak, capable and incapable, resilient and weak. There are differences from the first days of someone's birth, regardless of it, the wealth of the family. There's a big difference between an aristocracy and an oligarchy. Socialists are indignant, anyone owning property. But property is granted by God, among other things, as a reward for labor and as a means and aid to moral development. An aristocracy is concerned with the common good, not their own good. That's what an oligarchy does. Property is justified by nature. Nature rejects all forms of monotony, endless variety. There are certain things about you simply cannot change. And it comes from and is the result of labor in one way or another. Yes, it's true. People use property for evil, for idleness, for violence. But its abolition, I shouldn't say it's abolition, it just went into the hands of the Jews, went into the hands of powerful people who hated them. And he's going to find out just how bad that is, you know. Neither wealth nor poverty saves in and of itself. Race doesn't save one way or the other. Righteous people can be wealthy, and many were poor. Job was both. Christ praised the woman who contributed the one mite or penny or whatever translation you use in the Bible. That's all she could afford, despite the fact that the wealthy around her had you know, dump bags of coin in there. The mistake of socialism, according to Vestorgov, that it seeks to anticipate the transfer of the image of a heavenly and future state to earth, to our present state. But is it possible for the people around us? You know, Albert Einstein wasn't so bright. I don't know if you've come across that one quote by him. You know, I've talked about, not him personally, but the concept that the revolution will take over, and therefore, since communists are in power, work will then become a pleasure or something like that. Work will be voluntary. And Einstein believed that. Frankly, at the condition of modern peoples, any system is doomed to failure. One of the reasons I support the Taliban in Afghanistan is that that's the only option. How can you have liberal democracy in a country that has been at war for, what, 40 years? In dire poverty? What kind of moral system could you possibly have? Yeah, of course they stopped their drug war. I mean, they ended heroin production. But they just went and they put a gun to their peasant's head and said, if you do this again, we're going to blow your head off. That was the only thing respected at the time, but that can't last. So this very strict version of Islam has to be top down before anything else can happen. I don't care about their opinions, since they have been so, you know, their whole world is PTSD. All right. I think this is going to be a two-parter. I realize I'm over an hour. Because now Vestorgov starts talking about nations and nationalism. This is another area where he predicts things, you know, with tremendous insight. It just burns me that a man like him, with his talent and play, no one knows who he is. No one teaches him. He was a good writer. He was very well educated. I didn't agree with everything he said. But you know what? I look back at things that I read years ago. I don't agree with those either. Some of it. So we will finish this. Next time. And I really appreciate everyone listening. Bye-bye.